From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Capital Chat will be back next week, and you can find news about McClatchy's bankruptcy filing at capradio.org. We're going to start with a topic that might be too intense for young listeners, so please use discretion as we continue. Murder-suicides is what we're going to talk about. Three of them have happened in Amador County in less than 2 years, the most recent on New Year's Day. This is a community of just 39,000 people. At one point, it had the third highest suicide rate in the state, but there has been improvement. Amador County has dropped now to the 13th highest statewide. With the murder-suicides, though, domestic violence has come into the spotlight, and a group of people has started pulling together to try to do something. Healthcare reporter Sammy Kayola led a CAP Radio reporting effort on rural suicide in Amador County in 2018. She's gotten involved, and with producer Helen Barrington's help, we organized a conversation that we recorded last week in the studio. With me were Todd Reby, District Attorney of Amador County, Mel Welsh, an organizer with the Amador Community Response to Domestic Violence, and Tammy Crabtree, who is the Director of Operation CARE, and that's a nonprofit in Amador County that provides services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So I asked whether Amador County was experiencing what they're now calling a crisis, and the DA answered almost immediately.
Yes, I'd say it's a crisis. It's really grabbed the attention of our community, particularly since the murder-suicide that occurred. Domestic violence was involved in that, although it was unreported on New Year's Day. And then there was a murder-suicide in April. And the one that really shocked our community to its core was a very well-known family, very well-known couple, Brad and Mary Wheat. Brad had killed Mary and then killed himself. And that, to this day, is probably, everybody knows where they were when they heard that. I know what I did. And I think that people were they knew something needed to be done, but they didn't know how to organize. But it was in the back of their mind that we have to get a handle on this issue. And then what happened on New Year's Day, we had three deaths that day, which for our small community is huge. Not only did we have the murder-suicide, but we had a 20-year-old who I knew, a lot of people in this community knew, who allegedly murdered his father. So it was a bad day in Amador County. But I think if there's anything good that came out of that, that it woke us up and it galvanized the people in our community to come together and say, we got to do something. We can't just sit in our seats and allow this to happen. So we're looking at our best avenues. It's just not suicide. I mean, murder-suicide is the ultimate act of domestic violence. Mm. So it's domestic violence as well, and getting a handle on that. And what can we do? What can government do? What can concerned citizens do?
Mel, also characterize what's going on in the community, too.
Todd and I have been working in the domestic violence field together for probably 24 years. And I praise Todd for coming here today and also for speaking up in the community. There has not been a political response to this. We have not heard that because our community is in pain and in the last 2 years have been suffering. And there has not been that acknowledgement.
What kind of political response would you mean or want?
I would like, at least from our elected officials, perhaps the Board of Supervisors, different city councils, to recognize, acknowledge that this has happened, that we're, as a community, we're all hurting, and we want to join together, join forces on providing resources, if it's funding, if it's just getting the word out. But I think the first step will be acknowledging that this is happening in our community. It's a small community.
Part of the crisis here is getting people to come forward or know who's at risk.
Right. And I think that's one of the issues we've had at Operation CARE with being such a small community. And confidentiality is very, very important, not only to victims, but to their family members, their children. They need to feel safe coming to an agency like Operation Care, where they know what they're telling us is not going to be made public in any way. And I think that for their safety, especially for our safety, the people that we see are desperate. They're mostly women. There are men that come to see us that are not reaching out to law enforcement. We have an average of 300 clients we see each year. And on average every year, only 10 of those have reported to police. So you have 290 women, men, victims who are not reporting to police because they don't want it, anybody to know what's happening in their home.
Let's take that to the New Year's Day situation and how unknown this was to anybody that there were dangerous circumstances in the home.
That's one of the saddest things of all about this, is that it had been reported by a witness that, there had been 10 years of domestic violence, at least 10 years of domestic violence that was going on in that household.
Nobody knew, no agency.
Unfortunately, yes. It hadn't been reported to law enforcement. It hadn't been reported to any kind of governmental agency that has cross-reporting responsibility, and bring it to the attention so there could be intervention. And it just got worse, and it culminated in this tragedy.
Are you able to give us some of the details of what happened that day?
No, because when it's the place for that would probably be the coroner's office, because we don't get a case. They don't refer any reports to us when we have a murder-suicide because there's no case going forward.
Right.
So, you know, I'm familiar enough. One of the things we did do is take a look at the father's name to see if he was, if there was a case on him in our office. And if so, what was our response? There was no case because nothing had been reported. But we do that whenever there is a murder-suicide, to triage it, to take a look at it and go, are there any lessons to be learned from this tragedy? Should the punishment have been greater? Was the intervention effective? Did we not file that at all? And we maybe, if we had, there could have been some glimmer of hope. So we always do that. In this case, I think the thing that maybe would have helped is public education and getting the word out to everyone in our community what services are available and how they can be accessed, and do that in a discreet manner that it can be easily accessed by people that are in abusive situations where they know where to call. You know, I have a victim witness office in the DA's office. In order to access the services that we have, you have to file a report with law enforcement. However, Operation Care, it's important for victims to know that even if they aren't ready to come forward to report an act of violence, that Operation Care can help them even without a report. So getting that word out, educating the public, if I can. We lost two trials in a row on domestic violence in the last month, and it was a kick in the gut for us. It finished nicely because we won a domestic violence case last week. But in both the cases, the woman reported that her spouse had abused her, or her boyfriend had abused her. And in both cases, she recanted and went back to live with the batterer. And the jury, quite frankly, it's like, well, if she doesn't care, then why should we care? And they came back with a not guilty.
What about that behavior, Tammy? Step in there.
You know, it doesn't surprise me. That's actually very common. Women come to, we have a safe house and it's an emergency stay, so a 28-day stay. And for the most part, women will go back even before the 28 days is complete. There's a lot of reasons, but just thinking about the reasons that I hear most often are financial. You know, you're talking about a woman trying to leave and then start a life with her kids or herself on one income. The thought of having the person that you love go to prison. So if they say that it, on average it takes a victim seven times to leave an abusive relationship. Well, in this seven times, one of those times maybe the neighbor heard a fight or something and they called law enforcement. Law enforcement shows up and you didn't want that to happen. Well, law enforcement has to take action. Now we have a case. So during that time, the woman, the relationship, the love isn't lost. You know, it doesn't even matter how long you've been in the relationship. It just doesn't end when you've been hit or abused in some way. And so the psychological getting over that that basically that hurdle of the education, which understanding what domestic violence is and how you got to this place where you're not leaving, where you're not seeing that you're being abused, those are very important things. And it's always really interesting to us when women come to the group that they didn't realize that being hit or called names or emotionally abused in any way is abuse. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it's always been. Mm-hmm.
I have been told by many women who mm-hmm. have been in that situation that the word love, which you just used, isn't the same definition by which so much of the world operates, that there are so many factors woven in there and so much pain. So we say that with parentheses around right. the word love. But to get back then to what you were just saying, Todd, what's happening in jurors' minds then? Or is there a gap here in education and awareness mm-hmm. about what people in a domestic violence situation believe or go through?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head with it. It is education of the community to have them understand why a victim will act the way that they do in these situations. As Tammy said, it's financial pressure. It could be that there's dissuasion or threats that are going on. It could be that that's their only shelter and they don't have any place else to stay. You know, there's a variety of reasons. It could be fear for family, the children. It could be fear of pets. We've had that situation. Jurors have to understand why would a victim delay in reporting? Why would they recant? Why would they go back with the person who battered them? It's a cycle of violence. And experts can help. Experts are expensive. Now we get back to the resource issue of being in a rural county. One of the ways that we're looking at combating that is by developing expertise, because to be an expert, you just have to know more than the reasonable juror. Develop an expertise by having law enforcement, either an investigator within my office or perhaps within our sheriff's office or within the police departments, receive that extra specialized training with peace officer standard training post, such that they can qualify as an expert and educate the jurors about the cycle of violence. And then we could do that. That's part of their job, and we don't have to be spending $2,500, $3,000, $5,000 for an expert each time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the point we're making isn't that every domestic violence case has to be won in favor of the person bringing the charges,
no.
but just that juries would become more educated and not make, I think what I'm hearing you say, is some of the comments that would lead to make you realize there isn't an understanding yeah. of how a victim
but
behaves.
Even before they become jurors, the education, you want them to get in
sure.
that box with a bit of an understanding as to the dynamics of a domestic violence relationship. Because you can understand that from their perspective, I've had a juror tell me this, well, if she doesn't care, then I don't care. And we want to change that reaction. We want them to be able to have more insight as to what's going on.
That is District Attorney Todd Reby. Also with me in the studio, Tammy Crabtree, the Director of Operation CARE, which provides services to victims of domestic violence and assault. They are both from Amador County, as is Mel Welsh. And Mel, you started organizing back in maybe 1990 and mm-hmm. working in the community. Mm-hmm. Add to this picture about what people are saying and the impact of New Year's Day mm-hmm. and the two preceding murder-suicides.
I want to add to what Todd said again, and also Tammy, is the public education, educating people that are being battered, what the resources are. The second one is educating the community, the family, the friends. If they're witnessing, if they're hearing, if they're seeing, if they notice a bruise, what can they do? Where can they go? Operation CARE is where they need to go. The third one is the perpetrator and family and friends. They need to know that that violence is not okay. And Todd mentioned the cycle of violence. There's also the cycle of abuse. Have these perpetrators been abused? Has the woman that's being abused, is this what she knows?
Mel, I'm going to pause you there, because in this New Year's Day murder-suicide, 10 years mm-hmm. of abuse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's changed since you got involved in 1990? What results or shifts in the trend are you seeing?
We're seeing that it hasn't done much as far as getting better. And it's on us, it's on all of us in the community to make that shift, make that change. And I think we need to spend the next year really increasing public awareness.
You know, when you don't understand what the true definition of love is, and when you're accepting a form of love that is altered by violence, and you grow up in a home like that, you know, the possibility of you ending up in a relationship just like the one your mother and father were in is very likely. So I think the education at a very young age of understanding how you treat people, how you should be treated by others, and definitely the cycle of violence and how that affects people and how you can actually start in that cycle of violence. Obviously, people start in the honeymoon phase of everything's perfect, and it can go for a long period of time, a short period of time, escalate maybe to violence, maybe not for long periods of time, but just understanding how, and I know that the cycle of violence, when you put it on paper and show somebody, you can see it kind of click in their eyes. Oh, that's what's happening. The fight, the calling me names, the apologies, the flowers, the everything's going to be fine. And the walking on eggshells is still the most common phrase that I hear from victims about being in the cycle of violence.
Todd, can family members reach out to your office and work through your office even if there's no formal charge?
They can. Without a report, it doesn't have to be filed. Even if we decline a case for other reasons because we can't prove it criminally, we can still offer services through victim witness. In the event that there is no report at all, we would have a referral to Operation Care. In a situation like this murder-suicide where we have survivors, there's a report. And so services can be offered through our victim witness office, most important of which is counseling.
Mel.
And I wanted to add another thing that Operation Care does is works with the youth. They have curriculum in schools on healthy relationships. So kids early on know that this was not a healthy relationship with mom and dad, and this is what a healthy relationship looks like.
I think those challenges of denial and kind of an unconscious programming or imprinting, places where we aren't even aware of what we have started to believe or act on, I think all those areas are so tough psychologically. Yeah, Todd.
Beth, you talked earlier, and just to follow up on what Mel was saying, years ago, we had a very active social services director who has since passed, and myself, and he would go out to our medical community, to our clergy, to our daycare providers, to all the folks that are mandated reporters under the law, to educate them about what to look for and what to do when you see it. And we're talking about what can we do, and certainly public awareness and education is a big part of that, but so is expanding our eyes and our ears and having people that are going to be in contact with families that are maybe there's domestic violence going on, but they see the telltale signs and knowing what to do when they see it. And who to report it to.
This speaks to a public service announcement your office just put out. Would you explain how you reached out in this message on January 23rd, what the goal of it was in saying to people, here's what's going on in our community? I think this was another rare step from the district attorney's office.
Very.
Well, I just felt that it had to be done. There were a lot of questions out there. To the extent that I could answer them or try to provide further explanation, I just felt it was incumbent on me to do so. And it was a first step, and it's going to be part of an ongoing effort to educate in a wide variety of ways. There's downsides of social media, but one of the good things is it's almost free, and it can be discreetly accessed. So I want to use it as a teaching tool.
In that message from your office was written these couple sentences. It is encouraging that members of our community want to take action and assist in the prevention of domestic violence in our community. Public awareness is our most effective tool. And then you added, I welcome a system-wide analysis of Amador County's domestic violence services and response, which may reveal gaps that can be filled through grant programs, reallocation of existing resources, or improvement in interagency communications.
Yeah.
Mel, on the heels of what you just said, that you haven't seen significant change or results since 1990, might this work? Is there truly reason to be optimistic?
Yes. And because I feel this is a system-wide, coordinated effort with Todd and Tammy being the champions on this. And I want to step back a minute and say we're talking about suicides in Amador County. We're talking about murder suicides. We're talking about domestic violence. I want to say that Amador County is a really special place with a lot of really wonderful people, and we do rally around each other. It sounds like we're, you know, some isolated hick county somewhere. We're right next to Sacramento County. I can come to Sacramento and say I'm from Amador County, and people don't even know where Amador is from. It's a beautiful place. We have a great, vibrant community that really does care about each other. So that's what makes me optimistic, too. And I think we're all pulling together, and we're going to say, we're going to get this done. We're going to do something about this. We're going to get the word out, and hopefully in a year from now, we'll come back here and say yes.
I think that's an important follow-up that we should make happen. By the way, you can find a longer version of this segment at capradio.org/insight. Again, you just heard Mel Welsh, an organizer with the Amador Community Response to Domestic Violence. I also spoke with Tammy Crabtree, the director of Operation CARE, and that's the nonprofit in Amador County that provides services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and the district attorney from Amador County, Todd Reby, joined us as well. After a short break, Sammy Kayola will step into the studio to wrap up the conversation, and then I hope you'll stay with us. Later in the hour, we will share with you the deeply beautiful music of the South African male choir, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Their founder, Joseph Shambalala, died this week. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Amador County is like many rural counties across the country. There is beauty, simplicity, there's goodness in the people who create a sense of community and a devotion to small town life. But Amador is unlike many other rural counties in that it had three murder suicides in less than 2 years, the most recent being on New Year's Day. Community members reached out to our newsroom because healthcare reporter Sammy Kayola had done a project on rural suicide there in 2018, and they found themselves again searching for answers. So you just heard our conversation, and now Sammy is joining me in the studio. Hi, glad to have you here.
Hey, Beth, thanks for having me.
Will you go back to 2018, explain that project and whether murder-suicide was part of it?
Sure. So this was 2018, as you mentioned, and we'd come across the statistic that Amador County at the time had the third highest suicide rate in California. And I really wanted to know why. It was an area that's pretty nearby to Sacramento and a place where our radio station broadcasts. These are members of our audience, and it seemed like they were really struggling with a suicide problem. And so we started with what we call community engagement, which is basically shaping our stories based on the people who live there and what they think is going on. So we had not done much reporting in Amador before. I'd never lived in a rural area, and it was a huge learning process for me in terms of, you know, meeting with the people that were starting to talk about suicide on the ground, which was not a lot of people because it was kind of a stigmatized issue. And so we were able to sort of introduce ourselves to the community through a couple of events and newspaper postings, and we were able to really study what was happening. And there were a couple of groups we knew were especially affected, middle-aged men, teenagers, elderly people. We also looked at some at-risk groups like Native Americans and veterans, and we looked at really the factors. We just wanted to know why. And the biggest things we found out were that it was being silenced. People didn't want to talk about it. There was also a huge shortage of mental health workers, so that even if people were ready to ask for help, they didn't necessarily have somewhere to go. So that was the scope of that project. And the data I had told me what was a suicide, and it wasn't really designated as a murder-suicide, though I did know that there had been two of them in 2018.
Right, one in April, one in September.
Yeah, so it certainly came up in the reporting. But I talked to an expert, and I learned it was just sort of a different thing. And so we ended up doing a short story about murder-suicide, sort of like a companion piece. But we ended up not focusing on that for that project.
I think it was not surprising that people reached out to you again, and you had stayed in touch with a number of people in the community, correct?
Yeah, I did my best to sort of keep up with the families I'd spoken to, the community leaders who were really dedicated to suicide prevention, and I did sort of a one-year follow-up piece in the fall. And so, you know, a little after New Year's, I got this email from a resident. It was a local man who was really very upset about the New Year's incident, and he was afraid. He was afraid for his neighbors, especially for the women in his community. And he mentioned that he sort of thought murder-suicide needed the same treatment from CAP Radio as the Suicide Project. And I thought, wow, it's another really big issue. So let's see if we can have a conversation.
Well, he highlighted again that there was concern, but maybe it wasn't being talked about enough. And maybe there wasn't enough kind of out in the light conversation about domestic violence as a factor in murder-suicide. So let's talk about some similarities and differences from suicide and start with what are some of the differences? I guess we're kind of getting there in this conversation already.
Sure. So when I did write about this, I'd spoken to an expert. And, you know, we often think about suicide as closely related to depression. There are a lot of reasons that people die by suicide. But for many, it's a deep sense of hopelessness. And it's usually something that someone experiences by themselves, especially if they're not reaching out for mental health help. But murder-suicide, it's really about interpersonal conflicts. Mm-hmm. And the primary emotion there is not usually depression. It can be, but more often it's rage, a sense of revenge, or a need for control. So it's just sort of coming from two very different places. And I had interviewed this expert, Donna Cohen. She's at the University of South Florida. And this is a quote she gave me that really stuck. She said, "Suicide is an equal opportunity employer. Murder-suicide is sort of a different animal." Hmm. So these are very specific kind of domestic violence situations, and that's what's coming to light now after this last incident.
The data showed an interesting similarity, though.
Yeah, there are some risk factors in common, namely firearm ownership. So firearm ownership tends to be higher in rural areas. And our reporting, when we were in Amador County, we found that more than half of the people who died by suicide, we looked at a 7-year period between 2010 and 2017, more than half used a gun to die by suicide. And looking at national data, you can actually see that 9 of 10 murder suicides do involve a gun.
Hmm. Let's talk about the rural communities, because there are risk factors that many share. In that sense, again, Amador County is not unique.
Yeah, I would say a lot of the problems that I highlighted in the suicide series are not just Amador County problems. There are similarities. Gun ownership is one thing. We know about 56% of adults in rural communities live in a home with firearms, compared to just 15 to 30% in most large metropolitan areas. That's from University of Chicago. Like suicide, domestic violence is something people are hesitant to talk about. It's this issue we're talking about kind of brushing things under the rug, especially in a small town. I know our last guest talked about this concerns about confidentiality, about not wanting to reach out because you don't necessarily want people to know that you're struggling with something like that. Geographic isolation is a huge factor in both cases. You know, if you live up in a a small rural area. Maybe you live on a hill. There are winding roads. It's not easy for you to get to town to seek resources, even if you're ready to get them. And there's not necessarily a neighbor close by to check on you or look for red flags or make a call in your concern. So that isolation, I think, is a big similarity. And, you know, there's just other kind of economic issues in rural areas. You know, poverty can lead some people to have substance abuse issues. There's a lack of housing that can make people feel trapped, you know, if you're in a domestic violence situation. And even if you want to leave, maybe you can't find secure housing or a safe place to live. And, you know, just the overarching idea of untreated mental illness.
Right.
You know,
the group
can be a
actually
factor.
Wanted to spend an hour talking about, and I think this would be true of so many communities, just what isn't there, what needs to be done, how to identify problems. So I said there's this coalescing effort toward solutions, and a community meeting had been held. So let's use our remaining time here talking about that meeting and the looking forward.
Sure. So, yeah, there is actually a very active group on social media right now. There are nearly 200 Amador residents, most of them women, talking about what to do. And they did have their first in-person meeting on February 1. I couldn't make it. I was actually out representing CAP Radio as a quiz master at a local decathlon, which was fun. But I missed the domestic violence meeting. But they really talked about, okay, how do we reach the people that are not in this room?
Right.
And they talked about what outreach efforts they could do, including for Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, which is February, which they're really trying to get into schools and do something on that. And looking ahead, I mean, I think they've got some traction. I think, you know, they could mobilize around domestic violence in a similar way to how they got conversations about suicide going. They are having a meeting with the Board of Supervisors. That the supervisors have a domestic violence council. And that council is going to have an informational meeting on February 25th. It's open to the public. It's at the board's chambers at 810 Court Street, and that's at 6 p.m. on Feb 25.
All right, Sammy, I really like how we've been able to take this concept of engagement, apply it to reporting, see it in action in the community. And again, I'd highlight that the community actually wants to help itself. The people stepping forward are saying, we want to learn more, we want to be able to do more, and we're going to reach in every possible direction to try to do that.
Yeah, the people who are on this issue are very passionate about it. They care about each other, about their neighbors. And, you know, I think it's similar to what we saw after we published the suicide series. People really got to work. They've got a suicide prevention task force. They're hosting what they call mental health first aid trainings to sort of build up a community of people who are on the lookout, who know the signs. And I think if they have that same kind of momentum on the domestic violence issue, they're going to go pretty far.
All right. Thank you, Sammy. That's CAP Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Kaola. You can find a link to her reporting from Amador County at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Up next, the music and message of Ladysmith Black Mambazo.